I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Problems with digestion are increasing in our culture, and that includes symptoms like bloating, gas, headaches, fatigue, food sensitivities, arthritis, and more. A new book by my guest now links these conditions to improper digestion. Van Clayton Powell is the author of You Are Not What You Eat, Better Digestive Health in 7 Simple Steps. I'll get Mr. Powell to tell us about to tell us what's happening with digestion, what he suggests we do better, as well as some of the things he thinks we're told that aren't necessarily good for us. For example, 8 glasses of water a day might be bad for you, or that eating between meals may shorten your life. Van Clayton Powell is a registered psychiatric nurse who's also studied Eastern medicine. He is the founder of Mind Body Fitness Incorporated, where he teaches courses on advanced health and fitness to various clients. He has suffered from digestive problems in the past and has survived to tell the tale, and can offer some insight onto his own battle. The website for more is at youarenotwhatyoueat.com. The book is published by Mind Body Fitness Books. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Van Clayton Powell. Mr. Powell, good morning.
Thanks, Joe. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So, I mentioned that in the introduction, that 8 glasses of water a day, which has been suggested for years now, may not be a good thing for digestion. Now, in this book, you give us tips on how to digest better. But in the case of water, they tell us that we should drink 8 glasses of water for hydration. Does taking that away, I mean, it obviously helps digestion, but doesn't that affect hydration or the other attendant factors that it's supposedly there to help?
Yeah, great question. You know, and that is a common myth, that we need to drink 8 glasses of water a day to remain hydrated. And Dr. Margaret McCartney wrote in the British Medical Journal that this idea, we need to drink 8 glasses of water a day to remain hydrated, is not only nonsense, it's thoroughly debunked nonsense, and other scientists agree. And, you know, if you think about it, why do each one of us need 8 glasses of water a day? I got a friend who's 250 pounds, never exercises, eats junk food all the time. I'm about 130, 140, exercise all the time, eat great food. Why would we both need the same amount of water to remain hydrated? That's one thing. The other thing is that you know, the body's smart enough to know how to get fluids out of whatever it needs it. And most of the fluids in the body are produced by the body and actually reabsorbed in the large intestine. So it's not just Dr. McCartney in the British Medical Journal who talks about this. Other scientists have agree with her and concur with her. And, you know, if you look at where this idea came from, that we need to drink 8 glasses of water a day, there are some people who suspect what we really need to do is look at the power of the marketing campaign that took us from, not that long ago, this idea, if you saw somebody drink a bottle of water, you actually laughed at them.
Yeah.
Say, why don't you drink it out of the tap? And today, it's everywhere. Well, who owns those bottled water companies? You know, we need to kind of look at that, too. So you're just fine. Your body will generally tell you how much water you need to drink by making you thirsty. And the problem, as I talk about in the book, is excessive fluids around mealtime can interfere with the digestive process, which is why that provocative statement on the back of the book, 8 glasses of water a day, might actually be bad for you if you're drinking it in a way that interferes with digestion.
And the other thing that you suggest in the book is that the water shouldn't be too hot or too cold, right?
Yeah, and that's a real simple physiological thing, and they've been saying this in Asia for thousands of years, and, you know, they took digestion seriously way before we did, and that was the interesting thing, one of the interesting things for me, having come through the Western medical education system. I had a bit of arrogance about, you know, we had the monopoly on truth, and I had to open my mind over there and learn that, well, they've been dealing with these things for a long time, way before we did. So from their perspective, they say, well, you have this internal energy, and they call it chi or ki or prana or whatever, and that's interfered with whenever you put anything into the body that isn't at body temperature. The body has to expend energy to change it to body temperature. And there's actually, you know, as you know from reading the book, there's a lot of information in the book that's from Western medical model
well.
And there's the study in there I talk about from the German researchers who found that when we drink cool water, it dramatically increases metabolism for about 40 minutes, and 40% of that increased metabolism is the result of the body trying to change the temperature of the cool water to body temperature. So from from that purely physiological perspective, our body is wasting energy to change the water temperature to body temperature. So in the East, they, for thousands of years, saying drink water at about room temperature is the best. And so these German researchers seem to support that. So that's where this idea of don't be drinking ice water. Now, personally, you know, I like my beer cold. So yeah, that rule goes out the window. And as you know, also from there's a section in the book about how important it is to allow yourself to cheat on a regular basis.
Right.
So I have the ideal rules, but I also think people should cheat when it fits.
Well, whenever I get a health book like yours on the table, I wonder, because usually, you know, in your case, it deals specifically with digestion and how to improve that. Is there anything in the book that takes away from other things? Like for example, this eating between meals. If one is interested, say, in losing weight or in eating better, it's suggested that they eat smaller, more frequent meals. Does that go out the window because you're concerned about digestion?
Well, yes and no. First of all, it without a doubt, smaller meals are easier for the body to digest, and it's easy for those to be cleared from the stomach. And again, it's just basic physiology. The problem is when we put food in on top of food that's still in the stomach. So the rule is, and it fits that idea of eating small, frequent meals, but it adds an adjunct to it that's really important. Don't put anything into your stomach until the previous food that you ate has left the stomach, which brings up the next question, how do I know whether the food's in my stomach or not? And there's a simple test they taught me in Asia when I was studying these medical systems. They've been around for thousands of years. And what you do is you sip about a quarter cup of warm water. That'll give you a bit of a belch. Any natural belch will tell you the same thing. If there's the taste or smell of food in that belch, food is still in your stomach. Your body would prefer that you don't put any more food in yet. And in the book, there are two studies that I talk about that relate to this eating between meals problem. And the one was almost 7,000 individuals. They looked at lifestyle factors that affected longevity. And they came up with the usual ones out of these seven lifestyle factors, like not smoking cigarettes, getting enough rest, and things like that. But one of those seven was not eating between meals. And I remember when I first saw this study, I thought, what the heck is that about? Somebody's made a mistake and just snuck that in as a joke.
Mm-hmm.
But as I start to look at the physiology, what I came across was evidence that when you put food in on top of food that's already there, you dramatically increase the amount of time that the food stays in the stomach. So the other study that's in the book was they talk about how they fed this group of people a breakfast. 4.5 hours later, when they x-rayed their stomachs, it was a long time ago, they were x-raying all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of those subjects, the food had cleared the stomach. They brought those subjects back a few days later, fed them the exact same breakfast to the exact same subjects, but this time they fed them snacks afterwards. It, again, slowed down the amount of time it took for the food to leave the stomach. In one case, 2 hours, 5 hours. In one of the subjects, 13 hours later, half of that breakfast was still in the subject's stomach. Now, a few days earlier, that breakfast had left that subject's stomach in 4 hours, 4.5 hours. So you can see how much that can increase the amount of time that food is in the stomach. We don't want that. It means it's like your engine is always working.
Yeah, just food in the stomach, does that mean that, how is food removed from the stomach? Is that going to the bathroom, or?
No, what the stomach does is, what's in your stomach? Hydrochloric acid and digestive enzymes. So this is where the primary purpose of the stomach is a storage area. And actually, the top part of your stomach can expand up to 15 times its normal size, which I'm really happy about at Christmas dinner. But it's filled with this acid that could burn a hole in your skin, or enzymes that can take a steak and melt it into soup. And the purpose of the stomach is to break it down into this pablum or soup and then send it to your small intestine, where most of the digestion actually takes place. So that's what's going on in your stomach, is this acid and enzyme breaking down the food into this pablum and then sloshing it into the small intestine. And that's the problem, is when, you know, say you ate a sandwich and 4 hours later the food's broken down into this pablum and it's ready to go into the small intestine. There's a little valve at the bottom of your stomach called the pyloric sphincter that opens so the food can start to slosh into the small intestine. Well, if you then eat an apple or something on top of that sandwich that started to go out, the valve would normally stay closed for that apple you just ate, But it's open for the sandwich you ate 4 hours ago. So depending on your health and the compromised digestive system you might have, or any surgery or stress or whatever, things don't work correctly. We end up with things in the small intestine that shouldn't be there yet. Well, the lining of that small intestine in some places is one cell thick. One cell thick. It's easily irritated. Once it's irritated, things can end up in the bloodstream where they shouldn't be yet. And that's when we get this immune response and some of the signs and symptoms that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, so I sort of mentioned bowel movements. I guess that was the question in the last bit there. That's fine, because it builds into to what I want to talk about in terms of bowel movements. It may not be pleasant to listen about, but, you know, we all do it.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, so what is, in terms of what's expected or what's ideal?
That's a great question.
What have you found in the course of writing this book and your research?
And you know what? That was interesting, because when I tried to find out, okay, what's the accepted norm? And what I found out was that ranged tremendously, from people saying three times a day is a normal amount of bowel movements to people saying once a week. And I'm thinking, once a week? Wow, that's not good, because that's the final stage of digestion. And there's a whole chapter on that phase, and it's the important phase. It's like we're getting rid of the waste product. So the body's getting rid of something it doesn't want anymore, and so it's filled with toxins. We don't want that hanging around in the large intestine, in the bowel, because things, first of all, get reabsorbed that the body was trying to get rid of, and they're in a concentrated form. And the other thing is that as more and more fluids get reabsorbed from the stool, it gets harder and harder, and now it can irritate the lining of the bowel as well, and we end up with the same kind of problem we're talking about earlier, things getting into the bloodstream that shouldn't be there. So what's normal? Well, normally when you eat a meal, you get this muscle action through your intestinal tract, which moves things through your digestive system. So if you're eating three large meals a day, it's not unusual to feel the urge to have a bowel movement three times a day. The whole key is that stool, whatever, should be formed. If it have this kind of banana test, it should look like a brown banana when it comes out. If it's not, if it's loose, that's a sign that things are moving through your system too quickly. And if it's hard, that's a sign that it's staying in your system too quickly. So and as you know from the book, I think everybody has to figure out their own unique situation. We all have unique genetics, unique lifestyle situations, diet, stress levels, things like that. So it's really difficult for me to say what's right for you or what's right for me, and I try and help people figure out what's right for them as an individual.
So there are seven steps in this book, and we've touched on a few of them. You just mentioned maintaining healthy stress levels. We've talked about bowel movements. We've talked about fluids. Chewing, we have to chew our food, right?
It's a really good idea. The only one who can get away with it is my friend's Labradoodle, as I talk about in the book. I watch him eat, and it's like amazing. I mean, he doesn't chew. He just swallows.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you get so many more nutrients out of your food when you chew. There's even a case I talk about in the book where prisoners of war in a concentration camp in the Second World War survived while those around them died in horrific conditions. They survived by chewing every bite of their meager rations 150 times. Now, you know what? For us, it's, you know, for most of us, that's just way too many. Even 30 times is a lot, although I have a little song you can do in the book that will time it for that 30 chews. But not only do you get so many more nutrients out of your food when you eat it, and it doesn't matter what you're eating, if you don't digest it, I don't care how nutritious it is, but chewing has also been shown in studies to stimulate the immune system, stimulates the production of T cells and immunoglobulin A, also assists with weight loss. They found that when people chew their food well, they eat less. So they don't put on as much weight. And there's even a study out of Japan, I think the study was done, where they show it might help prevent age-related memory loss. So chewing, the book's filled with things like that, because I'm fascinated by those bits of information, and I think it makes it more likely people will follow these steps when they understand the physiology, the rationale behind them. I've learned that from working with athletes who, if I can tell them the why, they're more likely to do it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm just another guy yakking at them.
Yeah, having read the book, it's not difficult stuff to follow, and you know, it's not one of those things where you have to do something that'll endanger your life or be a risk later on. So, the other things we've already touched on are grazing, a part of the seven steps, of course, grazing, not eating when we're not supposed to, and then obviously exercise, and eating before bed is another one. You say in the book that we shouldn't, I mean, how long should we, when should our last meal be before we hit the sack?
Well, I guess it depends on what you're eating. So if you're eating fruit, it's not a problem. Fruit's normally going to clear the stomach in somewhere around a half an hour, and that's just an approximation depending on your state of digestion and how much fruit and the rest of it. But if you're having, you know, if you're getting up at 11 o'clock and or at midnight and going to the fridge and making yourself a leftover turkey sandwich or something, that's going to be in the stomach for a long time. So really, I try and eat, if I'm eating something heavy, I try and eat at least 3 or 4 hours before I go to bed. And the reason why is because the primary purpose of sleep is for the body to detoxify, cleanse, heal, and rejuvenate. It's not supposed to be digesting food, and it doesn't digest food very well at that time when we're sleeping because of the involvement of something called your lymphatic system. So we want food, we want our body to be healing and rejuvenating itself while we're sleeping. And if it's busy digesting a meal, it's not able to do that, which is why you might have noticed if you've had a heavy meal, you know, late at night, even if you didn't drink any liquor or anything, the next morning, sometimes you feel like you've got a hangover almost, very, very sluggish. And it's because the body wasn't able to do this detoxing in the middle of the night. And another reason why shift workers are much more prone to digestive disorders than the rest of us. It's because it's interfering with these natural rhythms that we all have, circadian, ultradian rhythms on when it's good to do this, when it's good to do that, and it's not good to try and digest food when you're sleeping.
In the course of the book, you talk about these problems that we have in our society, and it seems like the digestion problems, they've seemed to have increased in recent years. I mean, celiac disease is something that is quite talked about now. People not able to digest dairy. I mean, I had that problem. What do you think accounts for that? I mean, is it the way we're digesting the food ourselves, or could it be, as you'll read in other books, the sort of food that we're having and how it's processed, etc.?
Well, I think both probably play a role. I mean, the more that lining of the intestinal tract, again, is easily irritated by a full range of things. Very common medications can irritate the lining. Stress actually turns off digestion, can interfere with the digestive process. But the more chemicals you put into your system, the more chemicals that are in your food, they also irritate that line. So there's a section in the book on digestive aids and irritants, and unfortunately the list of irritants is much longer than the list of aids. But if the digestive system is strong enough, you can eat many, many more things without a problem. So I was one of those people. I couldn't eat wheat, couldn't eat dairy, couldn't eat soy, couldn't eat corn. I couldn't have chocolate or coffee because I had all these reactions, all the signs and symptoms of the digestive problems. But now I can eat anything I want, and it doesn't cause a problem. Now, the neat thing is that my digestive system is so strong, I get to cheat a lot more frequently, so I can get away with eating those things that might not be really good for me, but, you know, that's part of life and part of fun. If I go to a friend's house and they serve me a drink before dinner and then they make me this really rich meal and they want me to have some more drinks after dinner, I do it. There's a whole section in the book on how to cheat, as I say, because I think that's an important part of life. But you don't keep eating that way or you will cause problems in the digestive system, and then I think that's plays a large role in why we have this dramatic increase in food sensitivities and digestive problems. People's digestive systems are damaged. We need to eat in a way that enhances and strengthens the digestive system, and that's what this book's about.
And if the digestive system is damaged, it can be repaired, right? I mean, if you can't eat dairy now or have wheat, if we follow the book, are you saying that we can eventually?
If there's, you know, if you have a congenital allergy, you don't mess around with that stuff. If you're allergic to seafood or to shellfish or to peanuts or something, you never play around with that stuff. I'm talking here about what is food sensitivities. So sensitivities that develop over time.
I see.
I mean, I had never been allergic to or had a sensitivity to wheat before, but that slowly developed. And then, like you, then dairy was a problem. Those kind of things, I'm saying, yes, as your digestive system heals and strengthens, research indicates that people are able to eat those foods that used to be a problem for them.
Now, you mentioned earlier what our bowel movement should look like in terms of what's ideal. The other thing that I found quite fascinating in the book is how our tongues should look. And I guess in Eastern medicine, the tongue is used as a diagnostic tool, right?
Yeah, yeah, and we use it in the West a little bit, too. They just use it and have used it for thousands of years for much more precise diagnoses. I had a friend who learned to be an acupuncturist in China, actually used to lead tours to China. He came back with this coffee table book filled with pictures, color pictures of tongues. It was one of the grossest things I've ever seen. Green tongues, black fuzzy tongues, and tongues with look like shattered glass. And to them, each one of those indicates a different imbalance or medical situation. So they say, they believe that a tongue that's got a thin, clear film on it, that's a light red color, the tongue's a light red color, and it's got this thin, clear film on it, that indicates really strong digestion, almost like a really hot, clean, burning fire, because they use that analogy for digestion, a hot, clean, burning fire. When we get coatings, different coatings on the tongue, and these don't come off when you scrape them, that indicates that your digestion isn't working properly and you have toxins building up in the digestive tract. Well, they believe there's this bilateral relationship that if you can help to stimulate the cleansing of the tongue, you actually stimulate digestion. Now, whatever you want to believe about that. So what they do is they lightly, very, very lightly, scrape the tongue over a period of time. And what normally happens is you can never scrape that coating off, but by very lightly I use a spoon, edge side down, lightly scrape it, rinse my mouth and spit out, and then over a period of time, what happens usually is that coating on the tongue, in my case, it's when my digestion isn't working, it tends to be kind of a white cream color. That tends to disappear. And again, you're not trying to scrape that off. It won't happen. It's not like you just drank a glass of milk. That's coming off right away. This is a different coating that's actually on the tongue. So that's what they suggest doing.
What about when they say that you should brush your tongue when you're brushing your teeth?
Yeah, well, you know, that has a similar effect. In their opinion, the bristles are too sharp for the taste buds. They believe that you can damage the taste buds. That's why they actually have this thing called a tongue scraper, which is a real thin, bent piece of metal, very light metal, that you put in there and you kind of lightly pull forward. And I can't stress enough that this is just a real light thing that you're doing. You're not trying to scrape anything.
Yeah.
But I find a spoon works just as well. So that's what I have that in with my toothbrush in my in the bathroom.
Yeah. Other than to tell your story and give us advice, I guess, I mean, that's really the reason why you wrote this book, right?
Yeah, you know, what happened, people asked me why I wrote it, and there were kind of, it's like the launching pad was a tripod with three legs, and the first leg was my background in the Western medical model, as you mentioned. I was a registered psych nurse specialized in detoxification and addictions treatment, and another leg was my own chronic digestive problems, because it's just a nasty thing to try and figure out. And the third leg was my experience and training in Asia in their medical system, because that's where I learned this approach, that it's not just what we eat, it's how we eat. And that's when I started to get better. And so I wrote the book and submitted it to one of those global publishing giants, and an editor there got really excited about it and started to usher it through their process of publishing. And I'm kind of an impatient guy, I got tired of waiting, took it back, put it away, and actually then a colleague said, you got to finish that book, last December. So I pulled it out, finished it in May, and said, this time I'm doing it on my own, no more delay, and I'm putting everything I want into it. So I actually published June 1st, and that's how we got here. And I recognize that if I'd had this information earlier myself, my own digestive problems would have been a lot shorter. So that's where it came from.
And the reception to the book's been pretty good, right?
It's been amazing. We had over 70 people crammed into a room in Courtney on Monday night, and same in Campbell River Wednesday night. I've just been having standing room groups, and sales are going great, and it's been wonderful. It seems to be striking a chord with folks, and you know, they can download a free copy at the website at youarenotwhatyoueat.com, as you mentioned earlier, and they can, you know, there's three free chapters there that they can get and see if it's for them. And I don't tell anybody what to eat or what to do. I think we have to determine that on our own individually, but I do think that there are some things that are real basic in terms of our health, and a healthy digestion is vital. Whether you're an Olympic athlete or a couch potato, if your digestion isn't working, man, you're in trouble.
Yeah. Well, I do suggest people pick up the book. It's an interesting read. Van, I appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Joe. This has been great.
The website for more, youarenotwhatyoueat.com. The book is called You Are Not What You Eat, Better Digestive Health in 7 Steps. It's published by Mind Body Fitness Books. Its author, Van Clayton Powell, on the line from Comox today in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.